Intervju Radija Študent.
Well, and Wittgenstein says, he says a lot about the form of the book in the preface to the investigations. And one thing he says is that the book is meant to inspire or elicit thought, and he doesn't want to save his readers the trouble of thinking. And that would also sound a little like Heidegger, you might think. You know, we need some thinking around here. And you might think, well, don't we have a lot of thinking? Well, not of the right sort.
Goodman o Cavillo. Pogovor s profesorjem Russellom Goodmanom o ameriškem filozofu Stanleyju Cavillu. Fakulteta za humanistične vede v Kopru je ta teden gostila Russella Goodmana, zaslužnega profesorja na Univerzi New Mexico v Albuquerqueju. Goodman je strokovnjak za zgodovino ameriške filozofije, trenutno kot Fulbrightov štipendist obiskuje vzhodnoevropske univerze in tam predava o filozofih, kot so Emerson, James in Cavell. V Kopru je predaval o svojih srečevanjih, filozofskih in osebnih, s Stanleyjem Cavellom, velikim ameriškim filozofom, literarnim in filmskim teoretikom. Cavell se je sicer izšolal v ameriški filozofski tradiciji, v transcendentalizmu in analitični filozofiji, vendar se je kmalo začel spogledovati z evropskim filozofskim izročilom, z Nietzschejem, Heideggerjem in Wittgensteinom. Nanj je gotovo najbolj vplival Ludwig Wittgenstein, v čigar filozofskih raziskavah je Cavell našel skepticizem, ki ga ni mogoče ovreči z racionalnimi argumenti, treba se naučiti živeti z njegovo resnico. Ugotovil je, da je grožnja skepticizma osrednja poteza moderne dobe, tisti impuls, ki je zaznamoval veliko pomembnih filozofskih in literarnih del. Cavell vidi motiv skepticizma pri filozofih, kot so Descartes, Hume in Kant, prav tako pri Shakespeareu, pri Emersonu, pri Thoreauju, pri Becketu in v hollywoodskih komedijah o ponovnih porokah. S profesorjem Goodmanom, ki je uredil knjigo Contending with Stanley Cavell, smo se pogovarjali o tem pri nas prezrtem filozofu. Pogovarjali smo se o Cavellovem položaju v ameriški filozofiji, o njegovem pojmovanju skepticizma, o njegovem tolmačenjem Wittgensteinove filozofije.
So, Professor Goodman, on Monday you give a talk about the American philosopher Stanley Cavell. Let us start the conversation with a very general question. Why is Cavell such an important figure in American philosophy?
Well, let me approach it by saying that he's a strange figure in American philosophy in a lot of different ways. So American philosophy could just mean philosophy is practiced in America, but Cavell has taken America or American writers, and indeed the concept of America, as one of his subjects. And that's unusual. I think most Americans don't. They want to be international philosophers or analytic philosophers or phenomenologists. The idea of singling out America seems, well, perhaps a little risky and maybe suspicious. After all, why American philosophy rather than something else? And so he's taken on that burden. And he does it in a way unlike anybody else, because he's going, when he works on American philosophy, when he thinks about the American tradition, he thinks about Emerson and Thoreau, who are not even admitted to be philosophers by most people and most philosophers. If you utter the phrase American philosophy in America, most people think you're referring to the pragmatist tradition, to Charles Sanders Peirce and William James and John Dewey. And Cavell doesn't really talk about those people except to say that they should not be confused with what Emerson is doing and what Thoreau is doing. So in the first place, it's talking about the strangeness of Cavell, one aspect of it. In the first place, it's strange to talk about American philosophy in the first place. It's a minority of people who in America who are doing that. And then under that rubric, to consider Emerson and Thoreau is really odd. But of course, it's also original. And if you think, well, did anyone else take Emerson seriously as a philosopher before Cavell? And you come up with a couple of interesting answers. One, John Dewey did. Wrote a very, he didn't write a lot about Emerson, but Emerson appears in his work, and he wrote a really good piece on Emerson as the philosopher of democracy in 1903. So Dewey appreciated Emerson as a great philosopher of the New World. But even more significant, I think, is Nietzsche, who thought of Emerson, wrote in a letter that Emerson was one of the greatest philosophers of the 19th century, praised his sunniness, also criticized him in ways I can't quite remember, but Nietzsche took notes on Emerson while he was composing Zarathustra, and if you look at all carefully in Nietzsche's In the Gay Science and in the Unfashionable Observations, Schopenhauer is an educator, for example, Emerson is all over it. And so I think that's part of the excitement for Cavell of discovering Emerson in particular and finding this American tradition having played a role in the development of one of the really important European philosophers. So it's a kind of a, almost, as I was saying, a sort of risk in focusing on America, but then this focus on America leads out to European philosophy and through Nietzsche also to Heidegger. And Cavell's reading of Emerson is anything but confined to the shores of America. He wants to read Emerson in relation to Kant and in relation to Heidegger and in relation to Nietzsche. So that's part of an answer to your question.
The main concept of Cavell's philosophy is probably skepticism.
Yeah.
But I have some problems with this concept because I don't know if it is a epistemological concept or it's an existential concept.
Right. Well, that means that you've been reading Cavell, because when you read Cavell, he's merging the two, or he's looking at skepticism as certainly an intellectual problem, and he has Descartes on his mind, not the Greeks, but the problem of the disappearance of the world or the disappearance of something, and a kind of vertigo that Descartes reports in the Meditations. When you take the skeptical path, you kind of lose your bearings. He means all of that intellectually, but then he also sees skepticism as a way of life, so as an existential condition. And there I think he has two paths on two lines of discussion about skepticism as an existential, existentiale, as Heidegger would say. One path is to think of skepticism as a generalized condition of alienation in which we live in relation to the world. And so his readings of Thoreau and his readings of Coleridge, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, or an attempt to see skepticism as a way of being out of touch with the world, as something lived and something to be overcome in some way. But then, so that's one path, skepticism in relation to the world and our, our lack of intimacy with the world and our alienation from the world. Skepticism means that for Cavell. But also then he also is investigating skepticism as a feature of our relations to other minds, to other people. And that was an earlier set of writings. And I think his first big discovery in thinking about, so let me back up a little bit. There are maybe three kinds of skepticism, if we can simplify a little bit. There's this intellectual tradition, which you find in Descartes most emblematically. And then there's skepticism as, well, and let's stick with Descartes for a moment. In Descartes' version of skepticism, this the radical doubt, he's worried that, Descartes is worried that we are not in touch with the world, that we're radically deceived, that the evil genius, as he dramatizes it, has done something to us, and so that we're completely out of touch with the world. Well, a feature of that skepticism is that the worry is about something that's completely out of our control. If skepticism is merited, or it's something we can't do anything about, because there's this all-powerful genius, as powerful as he is evil, Descartes says. And so the classical kind of skepticism is one of a condition about which we can do nothing. But the kind of skepticism Cavell is interested in, particularly in relation to other minds, is a skepticism that we bring to the world or bring to our relations with others. It involves the will. And so this is an existential approach, because it's something for which we are responsible. If we live our skepticism with others, which for Cavell means that we don't recognize who they are and what they are and what they mean, if we fail to acknowledge them, as he puts it, then that's our problem. It's not a part of the human condition necessarily. So that's a big difference. That's a discovery, that there's a kind of skepticism, unlike Descartes' genius possibility, a kind of skepticism for which we have responsibility, and therefore for which, about which we can make a change in some way.
Can we say that in Cavell's quest of the ordinary, there is an echo of Heidegger's philosophy? Because he speaks of the ordinary as a lost home, which has to be found anew.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, and Cavell says, as I said to you the other day, in a parenthesis in his 1979 book, The Claim of Reason, he says something like, from time to time it will be obvious that I'm trying to understand or express Heidegger's philosophy in some way. So he's reading Heidegger. I think Introduction to Metaphysics is one of the books, rather than Being in Time so much, that he's reading.
What is called thinking.
And what is called thinking, yes. Maybe that rather than, I think that more. What is called thinking. Yes, recovery of an intimacy with being is a way of, and being able to listen to being and let it, speak to you. That's the way Heidegger speaks, and Cavell is, I think, doing something, looking for something similar, and finding that Thoreau first and then Emerson are involved in that project. But I think he also discovers, you mentioned the book In Quest of the Ordinary, you could say he discovers that Heidegger is a romantic, because the romantics are all, that's a fundamental romantic project, finding your home again. And Wordsworth says in his 1805 poem, "The world is too much with us." He says, "Little we see in nature that is ours." I'd rather be a pagan, so at least I could hear old Triton blow his wreathed horn. I'd rather be a pagan if that were the only way I could be in touch with the world. And so that's the root. That's Cavell's. I think he does more work with the Romantic poets in looking for a home in the world than he actually does with Heidegger. He comes to, they speak to him more.
S profesorjem Goodmanom smo se pogovarjali tudi o Cavellovi interpretaciji Wittgensteinove filozofije.
Back to Wittgenstein. A couple of elements of Cavell's interpretation of Wittgenstein. One, he sees Wittgenstein as a Kantian. We're talking about the investigations. Actually, Cavell does not write about the Tractatus, the first work. He only writes about the later philosophy.
Yes, he hardly ever mentions.
Yes, it's all. You can never hardly tell that Wittgenstein wrote this earlier book. So yeah, he writes about the investigations, the posthumous work published in 1953 after Wittgenstein's death in 1951. And he sees it as a Kantian work, that Wittgenstein's notion of grammar is the equivalent of Kant's synthetic a priori truths, that the grammar of our language, the structure of our language, forms the limits of our understanding in some way, and that if you try to go beyond those limits, if you try to get out of ordinary language, you're going to fall into some sort of transcendental illusion. And just as in Kant, we must restrain reason and critique reason so it doesn't try to do what it can't do, escape the limits of human knowledge. So for Cavell, we must restrict philosophical understanding in some way to the forms of human life and the language games that we speak. That's roughly the analogy with Kant. So he discovers that. And another feature of his Wittgenstein interpretation is to take the word therapy and the idea of the therapeutic seriously. There are a lot of words in the philosophical investigations. The word therapy only appears once. So that's a bold move, but it's in a very prominent place. It's at the end of this series of paragraphs. I think it's numbers 109 to 133, and it's in 133 at the end of the series, which is all about method, where Wittgenstein says that he is conducting some form of therapy, and that there are different therapies for different problems, maybe. He uses the word in the plural also. So Cavell takes that really seriously, and the contrast could be the contrast comes out in his the work of his first paper from 1962, The Availability of Wittgenstein's Later Philosophy, where he's attacking an earlier book by David Pohl, in which his understanding of Wittgenstein's method was that he was constructing arguments for certain positions. So therapy doesn't really come into that. You just have the good arguments and get rid of the bad positions. If you think of Wittgenstein as doing therapy in the way that Cavell does, it's a very different enterprise. And he is thinking of it as a kind of Freudian therapy, which, you know, I suppose a course of therapy can come to an end, but it also might go on for your whole life. And maybe your work with your analyst comes to an end, but you're still doing it. And so it's an ever-ending process rather than something that will end when you have the right argument. It's a very different picture of what's going on in the book. And so I think that was a revolutionary way to look at it, and a very useful way to look at it. And it fits what Wittgenstein says and what he's trying to do. We were also talking about this wonderful... So a third feature of the book. So we have the Kantian line in it, and we have the idea of therapy. And then there's the dialogical character of the book, and it's very obvious that Wittgenstein is writing. Parts of it are in dialogues, they're in quotation marks, and these voices are talking to each other. And then there are remarks that are not in quotation marks, and Cavell takes those literary characteristics very seriously, and I think he thinks that the dialogues are part of the therapy. And they're not the only part of the therapy, but the dialogical character, again, I think is a picture of philosophy as in conversation with itself rather than as a completed system. Let's put it that way. And so that's a very, revolutionary way to read Wittgenstein, and also a correct way to read the later writing.
I read a very interesting book about Wittgenstein's method by Wolfgang Pichler.
Pichler, that guy. Yes, okay. I don't know.
He's arguing that the form of an investigation, that it is very important.
Absolutely. Well, and Wittgenstein says in the preface, he says a lot about the form of the book in the preface to the investigations. And one thing he says is that the book is meant to, I don't know, inspire or elicit thought, and he doesn't want to save his readers the trouble of thinking. And I guess you could, if you follow an argument, that's thinking too. But the kind of thinking he's calling for is, I think, much more spontaneous and independent. Or, I mean, it's supposed to be, it's not the thinking of just following along the difficult path of a brilliant philosopher. It's thinking that somehow on your own that he's trying to encourage, and the form of the book is trying to do that. And that would also sound a little like Heidegger, might think, you know? We need some thinking around here, and you might think, well, don't we have a lot of thinking? Well, not of the right sort.
Na koncu je Goodman povedal nekaj besed o Cavelovem paradoksnem odnosu do analitične filozofije.
Well, and this is another thing about Cavell, that he is alienated from philosophy, or what he sometimes called professional philosophy, right? And Cavell started as a musician. He was a music major at Berkeley, and he went to Juilliard to study composition. And he was reading psychology there in New York when he was at Juilliard, and actually neglecting his musical studies and going to the movies. And there's a story about how he got into philosophy at Harvard, but once he was there, J.L. Austin was the man who gave him some direction and turned him into a linguistic philosopher, or a philosopher of ordinary language, which is what Austin worked on. He has a curious relation with it because he taught at, you know, the predominant American department, or it was in his day, that the department of John Rawls and of Quine and Nozick, and before that of William James and C.I. Lewis. So he's right there in the middle of the American philosophical establishment, but he's a very odd person.
He's very critical of analytical philosophy.
He's very critical of analytic philosophy, yes. Though he's also in many ways an analytic philosopher, so
I agree, because there was also a discussion if Wittgenstein is an analytical philosopher.
Yes. And you could argue both ways. Right. But, yeah. Of course, I would want to argue yes, because then analytic philosophy is much more interesting.
Okay, Professor Goodman, thank you very much for this very interesting conversation.
Glad to do it. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Profesorjem Goodmanom se je v balkanski različici angleščine pogovarjal Urh Vele.
Intervju Radija Študent.